Warning, this is not your father's history. This is not the history your coach taught you in high school. And you won't find it on the History Channel either. No, you see, this is the history your mother warned you about. This is History Against the Grain with your hosts, Chris Padgett and Josh Weiner.
Episode 68, The Narcissism of Power. Welcome to the podcast where we, in the words of Walter Benjamin, regard it as our task to brush history against the grain. I am one of your hosts, Josh Weiner, and with me today is an AI chatbot I call Chris. Welcome.
You know, you didn't give me a chance to rehearse what the AI chatbot version of me would say.
The technology's gotten so good that I think you're doing it very well.
It might be something like the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plains.
Well, so you've got to somehow be human but be wrong about everything. Sound exactly. Human but be wrong about everything. That's how it'd work.
Sound good but have no actual meaning. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was talking to you about this. Maybe we were texting about this. That there's this new the new push is AI grading. So we're going to get to a point where our assignments are created by AI, our students complete the assignments through AI, and then we grade them through AI, which it's just going to remove the entire human element of it entirely. Which does that mean we can retire or I don't know what that means.
We can virtually retire. I've always thought the problem with education was the human element, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we went to online, so we got rid of a lot of that. And now we can finish it off by replacing us with mostly wrong AI chatbots, the perfect technology for our age.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that because, you know, I've been doing a bit of grading this week. We are on spring break, by the way. Our listeners know, full disclosure.
That's why we sound so loose, so happy, because we're only grading half as much.
Can you tell the timbre of my voice had changed? Yeah, we're almost giddy, I think. But having even done some grading without the normal sort of heavy burden, you know, that spring break now has dutifully removed. I mean, it's lovely outside, you know. I told you I delivered a letter yesterday by hand to a mailbox down the street. I don't know the last time I'd done something like that, just so I could be outside. But yeah, so I've been grading and you know, our grading algorithm, which is sort of the counter algorithm, right, is Turnitin.com, and it now tries to give you a score for anything that was AI generated, right?
Yeah.
And I find myself wanting to tell students, look, this is, you know, not every time, but you know, I want to let it be known that I often like, well, maybe not often. I like what my students have to say.
Yes.
But there are sometimes I find myself saying, oh man, dude, you should have used ChatGPT. This is really bad.
I've gone the opposite way. The most beautiful writing to me is like the most awkward writing. If it's awkward and a little bit wrong and maybe doesn't quite understand what's going on, I'm like, that's the stuff. It's just pure. And then in contrast, you get this, you know, again, inhumanly worded, technically correct language that says absolutely nothing. Right. Which is what AI has brought us.
Yes. And so the world we live in, we've had conversations about this as a department even, and I would like to seem more vexed, more put upon by it. But up to this point, it really hasn't affected what I do, at least too much, because whenever I see it, it's so relatively obvious.
Yeah.
That I just created a new rubric score for, you know, something that was AI generated.
Right.
I use a digital device to signify that something was AI generated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, the thing that I agree with you, but the thing that frustrates me is this: there's this push to, I don't know, what do we want? Oh, to like integrate AI into our courses.
Mm-hmm.
not collaborating with the enemy in this on this one. That's my view. This is a bad technology which is going to undermine what's left of truth in this country, in this world, and we need to be pushing back against it every step, not trying to,
Yeah.
take part in and make use of it as a learning device in our classes. Because as people have been pointing out, there's been a lot of stuff written about this. The energy it takes to run these chatbots, to run these programs, is so massive that there's literally not enough power in our country to move
Yeah.
this up to scale. And what people are now saying is that they're going to start pushing for more drilling, more burning of coal, more energy use to maintain this. And over time, they're going to make us so dependent upon this awful technology that we won't be able to back out of it. So it's not just like, oh, it's inconvenient. I have to, write to students telling them I consider what they did plagiarism. It's literally, speeding up climate change and causing energy shortages and this sort of thing, all for something that doesn't fundamentally work and doesn't fundamentally serve any human purpose. So that's where I am.
That didn't sound like the McGraw-Hill ad I received,
Oh
Josh,
my God.
touting AI. And our episode today is called The Narcissism of Power. And we've talked before about the narcissism of high tech, which is its own kind of power, obviously. But one of the really awful things, in a catalog of indignities, we might call them, about this AI boom is that you're seeing the language adapted now in that kind of, sunny disposition, kind of that we're used to in education, because we're always subject to this. There's always the next thing you needed because you were doing everything wrong before, and now you have to have this so you can do it right, finally, is what I call that. Is that everything's being promoted in that kind of verbiage, that kind of lexicon. And so you get these, and they're full of platitude. I think there's a template, right? And they just plug in the noun they need, in this case, AI. But before, it would have been something like, some other panacea for education, right? I mean, sure, back in the days, it was probably IBM punch cards or something that promised to revolutionize teaching or something. And so we're having to bear witness now to these, really awful marketing efforts. And I'm always, reminded of Orwell's line about, the greatest threat to democracy is, insincere language, right? I'm paraphrasing, but it's something, and I find this to be about as insincere as language gets.
Yeah, I think the McGraw-Hill one was the one that promised us to meet with thought leaders to tell us about the promise of AI. Which, I sent you this long article on AI because it's kind of I'm obsessed with it right now since it's again it's horrific. But he was making the case that nobody can actually tell what it's for. They can tell you what it's kind of what it can be used to do, but not what it's for, why this makes anything better. So it just kind of fits into this. This fetishization, is that the word? This fetishization of like innovation and change and tech and all this kind of stuff, where we're at the point where the innovation itself is the benefit, whether or not you can actually make a case for the thing having value, right? And we're just pushed, like we talked about this, but 2 years ago it was Web 3.0 and the blockchain was going to be the big thing, and then it all fell apart, and we don't hear about the blockchain that much anymore. And now it's AI, and we're expected to just dive headfirst into these very muddy waters, not knowing what's underneath. And it's probably not sustainable in terms of energy, in terms of nobody can figure out how to profit from it. Nobody can figure out how to monetize it quite yet. But we're expected to, again, kind of collaborate with this literally the dumbest people on the planet telling us to adopt this stuff. And yeah, it's bad.
I think there must be a correlation, an inverse ratio or something between the insincerity of the language and the toxic effect of the product or
Yes,
something. Because I totally agree with you. And because we're in this sort of pioneer, stage of its development or something, we really are being treated to some of the very worst kind of marketing, and even in within the college, not just from the corporate publishers and those kinds of folks, but those of our own admin who are trying to hitch their wagon to the promise of AI by becoming what deans and learning specialists, and we're already getting that, in other words, and some of them are faculty, some of them are faculty. I'm not going to knock somebody for having a side hustle, but when your side hustle is AI, you know what I mean? I'm getting visions of Oppenheimer there or something. I don't know.
Or Jurassic Park, right? Just because you
Yeah.
can doesn't mean you should.
There you go. Absolutely. One thing we were talking about over the break, in addition to our apocalyptic, future, is an apocalyptic past. Or I say past because this is a book that came out even time I was a little tyke, but I remember sort of nerdy friends reading it in the 70s and 80s, and now it's a blockbuster motion picture. Of course, I'm talking about Frank Herbert's Dune. So my question is, do we see any symmetry here between the apocalyptic future promised by AI and whatever that was Frank Herbert was talking about?
I sent you a bunch of stuff about Frank Herbert to the extent that, because you haven't read the book. I've read the book a bunch of times, the first book. I haven't gotten to the sequels, which apparently are pretty insane. Yeah, I sent you a bunch of stuff, and I think the last thing I sent you, you're like, yeah, I don't, yeah, I'll just take your synopsis. I don't want to read this
It was about
anymore.
how white nationalists embrace Dune.
That is good. You should read it, but I understand why you
Yeah.
don't want to
Well,
touch
I
it.
just felt it was slipping through my hands. Here I had a kind of naive joy at the movies, not having read, like you, not having read the novel, and coming to it sort of, unwashed, unbaptized, and enjoying the movie going experience. But I'm afraid I've found my way into a thicket suddenly. And so I'm trying to understand, is the view is it meant to be a view of our own future? And if is that view, I see ecologically, I see a lot there to get our arms around, right? Environmental despoliation, that kind of stuff. But our theme today is power and the narcissism of power. Seems there's a bit of that as well, isn't there?
No, it, yeah, so I mean, without spoilers, the movie absolutely is about the kind of the machinations of power and the threat of demagogues. And again, don't want to say too much for people who haven't seen it or re read the book, but kind of the twist in the story is that the people you think you should be rooting for are maybe not the people you should be rooting for. No, I think it's a weird book, and as one of the articles I sent you suggested, Herbert was a very strange person with a very set of very strange influences and ideas who couldn't quite be kind of mapped onto our partisan divides. There are parts of him that are very conservative. There's parts of him that are something else. And then I think the book itself is kind of takes in all that oddness into it. And I think the film did a pretty good job of maintaining the strangeness of the story. We were talking about just comparing sci-fi, like Star Wars is George Lucas's, in many ways, his attempt to take the weirdness out of Dune. It becomes a very traditional kind of hero's journey story in a way that Dune kind of seems like it's going to be, and then ultimately is not.
Yeah, I was looking for a word, reading about Frank Herbert, that would describe all those contrary qualities that you describe, and I finally came up with one. It was Oregonian. He's a native of Oregon, and let's face it, people, native Oregonians are weird, Josh. I'm
Well,
just
yeah,
being
even worse, I think he's a Washingtonian and Oregonian. He has that kind of
Oh
PNW
my gosh.
background
So
more
the
broadly,
Douglas fir region of the Northwest, the land of, lumberjacks and hippie communes and right wing and left wing and everything in between. Remember the Keep Portland Weird? And I'm not even talking about the hipsters in Portland, you know. I'm just talking about the good salt of the earth Oregonians who, and Washingtonians who, I think can you know, cause this kind of you know, your normal categories of things to kind of go on tilt, because you know, here was a guy who was essentially a mineral engineer, I take it, you know, working for, well, first he was an aide to a right-wing senator who was, you know, the friend of the logging industry. So, you know, Frank Herbert, who's going to write Dune about the dangers of, you know, environmental collapse, was working for a senator who was, you know, doing his level best to harvest the Douglas fir region of the Northwest.
Yes.
Yeah. And then he like worked for what big, was it petrochemical or petroleum? I can't remember.
He was connected in various ways. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So he worked for some real environmental juggernauts there, you know, but then he also like what lived in, you know, essentially on an Indian reservation or near one, and even in Hawaii, he lived on Maui, you know, and Hana, you know, which, you know, was essentially a kind of native corner of Maui and about as far out of reach at that time as you could get if you're a white dude, you know, that had worked for the, you know, the big industry, big corporate industries. So yeah, strange mix of things with Frank Herbert. But I think as we talk about power in the episode today, you know, we have to almost go to where he was going. And I don't mean necessarily psychoactively, you know, but it may not hurt to understand what is often the kind of mind-bending rationales that are offered, you know, at the behest of power to justify, you know, a whole chronicle of awful things, you know. And we're so used to it, I think, that it almost takes someone of the artistic capacity of a Frank Herbert or, you know, a Tolkien or somebody, you know, who can kind of a world creator, you know, to kind of draw these, you know, these facts into our consciousness in a way that allows us to see them, you know, because the narcissism of power, I mean, one of the things we know about narcissists is they tend to be very charming, right? Very beguiling. You know, at least in the beginning, you know, they have a good come on, and they're not what they appear to be. Let's put it that way. So, yeah, we've been chatting a lot about Dune. We've both seen the sequel. I think we both enjoyed it. We both went to the movie theater for one thing.
Yeah.
But we find ourselves having these conversations of power. And sometimes I say, wait a minute, are we talking about Dune? Or are we talking about the Middle East? Which is it?
Right. Well, and that's, you know, where we want to kind of get to. I mean, we're not going to focus entirely on Israel and Gaza, but there are some kind of lessons that I think are becoming apparent based on the discourse, I think, on Israel and Gaza, even getting outside the actual, you know, war itself. The way it's discussed, I think, is very revealing of that narcissism that you talked about, because there's a set of assumptions that go into that, the dominant discourse, at least I'll say. That are being used to justify certain acts, that are being used to normalize certain acts, that are being used to make sense of violence in a way that is counter to a world based on peace and order, right? And so I think that's what we want to get into, issues of language, issues of power, issues of nationalism, issues of empire, and then just the kind of legacies of history that we're still feeling in our present.
Let's do it.
So something that happened in the fairly recent past that we haven't talked about, even though it seems like the perfect fodder for a discussion, is the death of Henry Kissinger, the long awaited death of Henry Kissinger. I would say I don't root for anybody's death, but there's certain people who, when they die, don't mourn them, certainly. and Kissinger is maybe the paragon of that. And he's also, I think, the best representative of the nature of our quote unquote global order. He's somebody who is massively influential and has been for what, 50, 60 years, something like that, well past the time that he was actually in office. He would continue to counsel people like the Clintons and eventually Trump himself as well. And so his kind of
Even
work.
didn't Xi Jinping like Henry Kissinger, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, of course.
Was there some weird connection with Kissinger in China? Because, yeah, okay.
No, he is his influence spread around the world, despite the fact that it doesn't take much of a a research to see the way that he spread death and destruction around the world throughout his time in office, I think in particular, and then even after, based on the model he set basically for how foreign policy was to be carried out, for how we should think about the world and our interests in the world. And
Look,
so, yeah.
we here at Hague, listen, we bear a burden, and that's calling things by their name. So let's call Henry Kissinger what he was, is a war criminal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was very revealing to read the obituaries. I probably maybe read more obituaries of Kissinger than any other recently deceased famous person, simply because it was so significant to read how he was presented. And a lot of the usual sources tended to wash away some of his criminality, we'll just say, right? And they focus on the complexity of Henry Kissinger. And then I think some of the other better better obituaries started with the fact of his criminality, the fact that he was a war criminal, the fact that millions of people suffered as a result of specifically Kissingerian ideas, if not Kissingerian policies. Did I just invent that term, Kissingerian? Anyway,
I think it works. I think it works. I mean, by the way, that's a great quality of narcissists, is to kind of dissolve that criminality, that toxicity, to dissolve it and spread it out over a bunch of other qualities that purport to actually be positive qualities, right?
No, I think
Yeah,
that,
so.
and it also just speaks to, again, who gets that grace, we'll just say, to be complex versus just being evil. Me and my brother always had this thing about, which bodies get counted, like, because there's always, people want to count the bodies of this regime or that regime, but you don't generally get that same body count being applied to these specific politicians in Europe and in the United States. It happens sometimes, certainly. King Leopold of Belgium has had his body count added up, but somebody like Kissinger is able to exist, separate from that body count. Whereas, certain people will always want to, start every discussion of Mao with the number of people who died in these Maoist famines, right? And that's not to say Mao is therefore good and these other guys are worse than like that, but just these are criminals, right? And they
No,
should be called
listen,
out for that. Yeah.
that's a great point. I have to give you props, because you and Benno, if you guys are, ruminating on what would we call it, the narcissism of numbers or
Yeah.
politics of numbers, because the example I'm going to talk a little about later is notorious for not counting bodies. And then when it did count bodies, undercounted. And I mean, that let's say that that is one of the, if we're creating a list, how do you know if you're a narcissist of power that body count has got to be on there?
Yeah, that's right. So Greg Grandin is a, to me, he's a really impressive historian. He's very much a, in some ways, an institution. I think he's at NYU. He's written popular histories, but he also, is a amazing critic of, we'll just say, American power and American foreign policy in a way you don't expect from popular historians. And so he wrote it's actually a pre-obituary, because this was published in Jacobin, the kind of left-wing journal. And he wrote it in 2017, I want to say. And he wrote it, in preparation for the eventual death of Kissinger. And it was reprinted upon Kissinger's death. And he, I think, kind of speaks to the problems of seeing Kissinger as this complex person, Because one of the things he identifies is that for all the kind of language that he uses, the kind of intellectual legitimacy he has because of his education, his ability to use language effectively, there's an emptiness at the heart of this kind of, I guess I'll use this term more, this Kissingerian worldview and this Kissingerian foreign policy view, which Grandin, I think, gets at expertly.
Yeah, I mean, he I don't want to steal your thunder. He comes close to me, you know, when I read the article, he comes close to, I think, putting his finger on something important. For all the pretentiousness that surrounds the describing and evaluating of Henry Kissinger, like you say, the complexity, the adroitness, the far-seeing this and that, the historical. I mean, Kissinger was a historian, right? He was a Harvard historian, right? I read his book in graduate school on the Congress of Vienna, you know, but which was terrible, by the way. But anyway,
The reviews are in.
is that you can kind of fog it up that way with a kind of pretentiousness. But it seemed like almost what Grandin was saying to me when it came down to it, he didn't have any really strong principles that he was, you know, sort of morally grounded or invested in. You know, it was almost a hustler's ethic. You know, how do you get what your interests dictate most effectively? I mean, shorn of all its ornamentation, it seems to me that's what Kissinger was about. And you know, he Grandin talks about his youth in Nazi Germany, and I don't know. Go ahead. Anyway.
It's an incredible biography, just like absent, all the other stuff that he did. It is a truly incredible, kind of mid-century biography. But, Grandin has this line. He says, Vietnam revealed the moral emptiness at the center of Kissinger's philosophy of history, which is what you're talking about, that there's no real principles at the heart of it. It's just power for power's sake in some ways. Grandin continues, over the years, Kissinger repeatedly urged America's leaders to state their vision and make clear what they meant to accomplish with any given policy or action, to not, as he put it,
Not put it.
exalt technique over purpose. Such advice makes liberals swoon since it seems so, well, serious. But Kissinger could never define what he meant by purpose. And this is why he gets flocked to by people like Hillary Clinton, who bragged in the 2016 primaries about her friendship with Kissinger. And in one of, I think, Bernie Sanders' best lines, he said, well, I want to tell you that I'm definitely not friends with Henry Kissinger. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing at the heart of it. It's this idea of purpose, but as Grandin says, he can never actually define purpose. There's this idea of interest, but he can never actually define interest. And so what you're left with is just power for power's sake. And that really is at the heart of, I think, this world order that continues to exist such as it does, is that it was always about power. It was always about the exercise of power, and it was always about using language to hide the reality of that exercise of power.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I mean, for years, teaching US history, you know, because I was too young to have obviously to have served in the Vietnam War, to have been drafted. You know, my older brother could have been, but I was too young. But instead, you know, I had this sort of front row seat in the 70s to all the guys his age and older who were coming back from Vietnam, you know, the famous Vietnam vet, right? You know, and, but it wasn't until later, you know, until I read, you know, a lot of really, you know, important works and, you know, both sort of war reporting and then later histories, you know, of what was going on, that I understood, you know, the scale of destruction that the United States unleashed in the Vietnam conflict. You know, I call it the Vietnam War. Remember, it was one of many. We're going to refer to, another author later is talks about small conflicts or small
Yeah,
wars.
small
It was
wars.
never declared a war, and unlike the way World War II was by Congress, right? It was a police action, and they had different names for it. But anyway, the sheer scale of destruction, for much of which Kissinger was first the national security advisor to Nixon, and then was his Secretary of State. So a lot of his fingerprints were on that war. And I mean, there are a lot of different ways to measure it. Ironically, the US was using body counts at one point to try to overcome the difficulty of showing a kind of terrain-based battlefront. You know, it was a guerrilla war. And so the idea was if we killed a lot of their fighters, we must be winning or something. But so body counts do come in, but the body counts were always manipulated, you know. So there's our narcissist element. But another narcissist element was, you know, this idea that it was justifiable to use the kind of World War II era bombing technology, strategic bombing, area bombing, you know, B-52s flying above what was essentially civilian country, you know, where it was imagined that guerrilla fighters, you know, the famous Ho Chi Minh Trail, that somehow there was a secret, you know, maybe subterranean supply line that that merited an unprecedented rain of destruction. The target bombing, you can go on YouTube today, Josh, and just look up, you know, U.S. Carpet bombing, you know, of and it wasn't just North Vietnam, you know, this idea that there was a line that separated communist North from the South, but it was also in South Vietnam. They were bombing South Vietnam, the country that ostensibly we were there to preserve for democracy. And then eventually, thanks to Kissinger, also Cambodia and Laos. And you can tie directly what happens in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge to the absolute breakdown of infrastructure and governing authority, thanks to American bombing in Cambodia. You know, so one of the worst sort of genocidal rampages that will follow is directly correlated to what the U.S. was doing. While lying about it the whole time. So that narcissistic element, you know, pretending that you're doing one thing, you know, that you're fostering democracy, right? That you're, you know, you're standing up for values that everyone believes in the age of the Cold War, et cetera, you know, was really just a gory, very bloody campaign of destruction for what were essentially political goals.
Yes.
You know, I think hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths.
And the point you're making is that what makes it so especially narcissistic is that attempt to take these horrific things and then use the language of order, the language of peace, the language of security, the language of democracy to cover for what's happening. And that's in many ways a very modern thing. And it's, you know, part of this kind of, you know, what Priya Sadia would call this kind of, you know, kind of liberal imperialism, right? In which you can't do these things, just at least stated the goal can't just be for interest, can't just be for power, can't just be for wealth. There has to be some moral aspect to it. But what that ends up with is this situation where you're bombing people to save them, right? Where you had to destroy that village to save it, right? Where you have to do all these things. And that very much leads us into the world we're living in right now, in which, you know, the situation in Israel and Gaza continues. The death tolls continue to mount, and the language and the way we talk about this continues to be that language of liberal imperialism, that language inherited from, you know, from Kissinger and his idea of purpose. And that's the thing that's been most clear to me in this, the discourse about Israel and Gaza, is that the hollowness of the language we use to describe violence. And so this is not, you know, an attempt to say much about the actual events so much as the way it's talked about. But maybe the best example is this issue of defining genocide, right? This has been a big issue, and South Africa brought this case to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, to charge Israel with genocide. And this is an ongoing thing. And I understand the power of that term genocide. I understand why it carries so much weight. But what I keep thinking is, so what if the ICJ ultimately determines that Israel is not committing genocide? What does that then mean? Is the violence they're inflicting now justified because it's not genocide? Is it now appropriate? Is it now moral? And that kind of gets to the problem of language when it comes to violence and warfare, is that as soon as we apply the language of law to acts of state violence, what we're implicitly doing is suggesting that there's an acceptable level of violence, right? And we see this in a lot of the opinion pieces on Israel-Gaza, where people like Nicholas Kristof, Thomas Friedman, I'm trying to think of other people who have done this. There's a whole litany of these kind of foreign policy writers who have done this, where increasingly they're coming around this idea that Israel's going too far, that they supported Israel, as Nicholas Kristof said, supported Israel's right to strike back against Hamas. But now they're saying, but this goes too far. And that raised the question. I'm glad that people like Friedman and Kristof, who were supporters of the Israeli retaliation, are now coming to the conclusion that this is bad, and Christoph's article in particular has a very touching focus on the children of Gaza. But it leaves me wondering, well, so what is right? What's the right response? Is there what's the way of fighting this war, of striking back, as Christoph says, that kills just the right number of people and not too many people, right? It leaves us in this kind of moral black hole where we're saying certain numbers of people have to die. But the question is, what level of death is acceptable and what level of death is unacceptable? And to me, that's sick and it's wrong. And it is so much a part of how we think about violence in this world, is that it ends up being a bunch of opinion writers and journalists and politicians and others determining who needs to be sacrificed for the purpose of this world order.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, that's a powerful statement, and I think the farther we get away from those kinds of values, the worse off we become. In other words, I don't want to be the arid academic, who says, well, there's a bigger picture or something like that, because the bottom line is what you just described, just as it was in Cambodia, just as it was in the Philippines, I'll talk about in a second. Just as it has always been, and yet, as you also point out, there's a rubric to somehow score it, to make it, if not strictly quantifiable, then kind of morally quantifiable as greater or lesser or justified or not justified. But when we look at these things again, what we find is a kind of narcissism of power at work, because narcissism is productive of great damage. I mean, you talk about narcissistic personality people, they create a lot of hurt ultimately. They don't have empathy. They are entirely self-entitled and have a kind of elevated, assessment of their own capacities. And so it's a devilish thing. And as far as I know about it, there's no real cure. You can't really fix a narcissist, Josh. And so I come back to this idea of, we need to call it what it is, or we're always going to just be responding, even if in anguished, ways, as so many are now with what's happening in the Middle East, and in the humanitarian bent of it, but we're always going to be reacting that way, and so we can't fix it. We can't say we've learned a valuable lesson or, something like that, because it's essentially built into the system. The narcissism is built into the system. And so it's not a coincidence, that we're talking about Henry Kissinger or talking about Gaza, or maybe talk about the Philippines here in a second or something. And we could pick, it's look, this is low hanging fruit in some ways. There's so
There's
many
too many examples. I
examples.
could talk for 2 hours about this.
Right. And we can find, as we've talked about in another episode, we can find all kinds of, sort of threads of continuity here, that get back to this idea of these systems that are created in the early modern age. Look, it's not to say, you talk about something like genocide. I hear the ancient Assyrian people or the ancient Assyrian rulers were really, sort of terrifying. They used terror as a kind of policy of, territorial consolidation and, forced removals of people. So I'm not trying to say there was an era of human civilization which these things, were all groovy or something. But let's face it, most of what we're talking about here is a product of the last, what, 300 years
Yeah, I was going to
of
say
the
two centuries,
systems?
but yeah, I think you could say 200 to 300 years.
The systems that were created in the early modern era, right? Including those that we call liberal democracies. Right. Henry Kissinger was the point person for a liberal democracy. Benjamin Netanyahu is the prime minister of a liberal democracy. It's often said Israel is the only liberal democracy in the Middle East,
A liberal
Vladimir
democracy. It's not a
Putin is
liberal.
running for re-election this week, isn't
I know. I can't wait to see the returns on that. No, you're right. This again, that kind of straight line, history doesn't repeat itself. It's just the same. We're the same people is the problem. And I think what we're kind of seeing, and is that legacy of empire, that the historical dimension of the language we're using to describe violence, that language that, you know, censures certain kinds of violence and celebrates other kinds of violence, is the language of colonialism and empire. That essentially that world order created in the time of modern imperialism continues to be the basis and the set of assumptions that ground our own sense of world order. You know, the language we use to discuss violence is a direct inheritance of language that these empires used to use to describe their own violence. You know, they always went to war to create order, to create peace, to you know, maintain security, whereas those who fought against them were always the agents of chaos, hoping to undermine that security. You know, the British like to say they brought peace to India, even as they were literally murdering people, you know, to maintain that peace. And so the issue is that as long as we have unequal legal orders, right, in which people are not all treated the same, as long as there's an imbalanced international order as well, as we continue to see, then labeling things will never be enough, right? Labeling things as genocide or not, since those with power can always define their acts of violence as falling within the acceptable level. And that's the real danger of, you know, thinking of violence in legal terms, is that, well, what does that do? What's the threshold? And what does it mean to fall below it? What does it mean to go above it? It's not, it turns out, obvious where things fit. And that's, again, something that goes back to that story of empire. So you want to talk about the Philippines, which is, you know, I think a signature example, and you know, the biggest part of the old American overseas empire by far. I believe, you know, the subject population of the Philippines was bigger than all the other imperial territories of the United States empire. And that territory was brought into American empire, not through, you know, an act of charity, not through an act of attempted to save people, but an act of extreme violence, in fact. And so you wanted to get into that, and just also the language in which that conquest was discussed, certainly at the time in the early 20th century.
Yeah, the language and the subsequent narrative that comes out of it, you know, as you and our listeners know, you know, I've become nearly obsessed with this idea that what we think about the past is often conditioned by the way we tell the stories, right? You know, and yeah, and I want to be clear, by the way, you know, because I hope I didn't sound like I was saying, well, you know, there's a fundamental pathology at the heart of Homo sapiens, and here we go again, or something. I mean, I don't know if there is or isn't. I tend to think that it's too easy, it's too facile to say, well, you know, we're a violent species. I think that's true enough, but this is a specific kind of violence. So what I want to say is that we're living, it's just that we're living in the same historical moment over the last 300 years. We don't always look at it like that, right? I mean, you know, in popular terms, we think, oh, well, no, we're living in the 21st century and what happened 200 years ago is very different. But the world historian in me wants to say, no, we're living in the same historical moment as, you know, the Dutch East India Company and, you know, the British East India Company and, you know, the pearl divers off the coast of Venezuela. And you know what I mean? The colonial. What we sometimes call the colonial period. So, all right. So anyway, so that's why I see the continuity, because we're living in the same historical epic. And the fundamental premise of it, and whether you're a Marxist historian or some other model, you know, the mode of production, whatever, it hasn't changed really significantly whatsoever. And so the fact that we see this narcissism of power, I think, I saw just recently where geologists voted down the Anthropocene as an official epic of geology. You know, did you know that?
But we can still, historians can still use it, right?
Yeah, and it's not that they don't like it or understand the effect that mankind has had on even the geological record of the Earth. It's just for sort of purely academic, conservative, disciplinary reasons, they're not quite able yet to call it a geologic epic. But even they acknowledge that. Yeah, the last 500 years, the last, you know, to take your number, 300 years, that this is an epic, a historical epic. So, as you pointed out, whether it be imperialism and the rise of the nation state, and the ideologies that support them, you know, is on display in some really interesting ways Almost hidden in plain sight. I mean, the thing that got me thinking about the Philippines. Well, first of all, let me just give you the quick context of this because it's still not terribly well known. I guess people have heard of the Spanish-American War, right? Just because it has a certain ring to it or something from history class. But it's not the Spanish-American War necessarily that I'm talking about here. The Spanish had colonized the Philippines, that's true, for several centuries, going back to the beginning of this early modern era. But it's the war within the war that what comes to be known in the US as the Philippine Insurrection. The Spanish who actually surrendered to US forces in Manila Bay, famously the Battle of Manila Bay, which took all of about an afternoon, to complete, with what was then the beginning of America's new Navy, modern Navy. The Spanish surrender quickly and basically cede the islands into U.S. custody. And it's only at that point, then the Spanish-American War itself is over, that what I'm talking about, a much bigger conflict, a much more destructive conflict that is often called the Philippine Insurrection in U.S. history textbooks, takes place. And it takes place, if you look at most textbooks, Josh, and I taught it this way for a long time, it takes place for about the next 3 years. That is from 1899 to about 1902, 1903, when it's proclaimed by President Roosevelt to be over with the surrender of Emiliano Aguinaldo, who was the Filipino nationalist leader who kept fighting against the United States, even though initially had been allied with the U.S. Due to their common enemy, the Spanish. But when he saw and he prepared a Declaration of Independence and he paid, obeisance and homage to the US, wrote a Declaration of Independence, what he saw, of course, almost right away was that the United States had no intention of seeing the Filipinos become an independent, self-governing people, but instead parlayed with Spain to literally purchase outright for a cash sum. It's not even enough to get you a good shortstop these days in the major leagues, but it was a lot of money then, $20 million, all 8,000 of the Filipino islands. And just, I guess, to sweeten the deal, Puerto Rico and Guam were thrown in as colonies. So the United States
I think
was
it's Daniel Immerwahr has that talks about that moment where, having just defeated the Spanish, the Americans go and celebrate in Manila with the Spanish, and while Aguinaldo is left outside the gates,
the
realizing,
suburbs,
that he's on the wrong.
unreal, unreal. And yet Aguinaldo's troops, seeing themselves as proud Filipino nationalists who very much intend on seeing their country become independent now under presumably some kind of liberal democracy, constitutional order of some kind, nevertheless, are faced with the intransigence of the United States, which has no intention for that. The U.S. interests in the Pacific Rim was so already strong by that point that this was part of a larger strategy now to build a global presence for the U.S. And so they're sitting there facing each other awkwardly in Manila. These Filipino national troops and these U.S. troops who previously had been ostensible allies now figure to be new enemies. And that's exactly what happens because, for the next 3 years, the U.S. is going to go to war, and we're going to send about, if I memory serves, I want to say something like 80,000 soldiers to the Philippines. So this is very much in line with what we think of sort of, I guess it would, what would you say? I guess I would qualify as a small war in the way it's framed, but small wars, as we know, whether it be what's happening in Gaza, territorially maybe small, or I know there are different ways you can define this, as opposed to what global wars, like World War I or something, that it's nevertheless significant scale. 80, 90,000 U.S. troops are being sent in for the first time in U.S. history. The United States is presuming to have a kind of overseas, strong military footprint, in a place that it is planning to annex as a territory. And by the way, lest anybody left hanging, that's what's going to happen. The United States is essentially going to annex the Philippines, having already purchased the Philippines outright from Spain. And it won't be until 19, I want to say 46, I may be off there by a year or so. It won't be until after World War II that the US actually acknowledges what will then be, for the first time, independent nation of the Philippines. So that's a half century, basically, but at the beginning of that period, the thing that I want to talk here about a little bit is what we call then in the US the Philippine Insurrection. Now we have to pay attention to language here because that was really a term that we borrowed from the Spanish. When the Spanish were attempting to hold on to their colonies, including Cuba and the Philippines, they regarded any of the freedom fighters, the native freedom fighters, Filipinos, Cubans, as insurrectos, right? They called them insurrectos. That is a kind of criminal labeling of those who were warring against duly established Spanish authority. So I think it's very instructive that we end up referring to this conflict that's going to unfold in the Philippines as the Philippine insurrection, because it implies what? It implies
Well,
that they,
yeah,
go ahead.
it delegitimizes their cause, and it legitimizes American ownership of the Philippines, which, it goes back to what I was saying, is that that's the imperial language. It's always going to legitimize the actions of power, and it's always going to delegitimize any acts in opposition to that power. There's this recent book called They Called It Peace by Lauren Benton, and she's going to make this case about small wars and the, how small wars really define the modern world. And this is exactly the kind of thing she's talking about. These kind of insurrections, she says, insurrections, acts of retaliation, interventions in non-European polities to unseat dangerous enemies, these and other colonial conflicts qualified as small wars. And it's always based on, on language, right? That's how they get understood. And I think, it's really powerful how you can call these people in their own homes the insurrectionist,
Yes.
while the occupiers or those who wish to occupy become the bringers of civilization, the bringers of order, the bringers of peace, even as
Right.
they murder everybody in front of them.
Right. And when you read the language of it, it's really maddening because, particularly from our perspective, now more than a century later, we've seen this thing repeated so many times, is that the language always frames it in some kind of either paternalistic, I mean, McKinley, President McKinley at the time was, because there was going to be a strong anti-imperial lobby in the United States for a while. It's not as if everybody was buying this. And, McKinley was pilloried in the press, a certain kind of critical press, for being the American paternalist, taking, our little brown brothers, as they were called, the Filipinos, right? I mean, it's Rudyard Kipling's famous poem, The White Man's Burden. He writes that specifically for the US annexation of the Philippines, maybe the most famous kind of racist imperialist poem ever written in the modern age, was written specifically to laud the US annexation of the Philippine
I mean, to really
Islands.
to lobby for it, right? Right, because there was that opposition to it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but even that anti-imperial lobby in the United States was often based on racism itself. This idea that we don't want to have, this white man's burden, basically, right? That's we. I think there was a line I've seen that where one person complains, it's a Southerner, we have borne the white man's burden for as long as this country has existed, and we don't want to, add to that with
Right.
these new burdens. So, it's not like the
Absolutely.
anti-imperialists were on the side of morality either. And not, I mean, certainly there were some were,
Right.
but there was that heavily racist anti-imperialism as well.
Yeah, no, it could work that way. You're right. And I remember Priya Sadia talking about the British mandate of Palestine, right? And how the British were encouraging Jews to migrate from Europe to Palestine, partly because they were anti-Semitic. They didn't want Jews in England, So yeah, there's always that kind of, the racial element always sort of bends back on itself in really, sort of interesting ways. Look, I mean, and it's all over the Philippines. It's the US troops, the white troops. Well, it's a segregated army. There are black troops, there are white troops, but they fight in separate units, not equally, are they treated within the military? In fact, the US white soldiers in the Philippines refer to Filipinos by the N-word. And that's one of their epithets, their slurs that they use, is they simply refer to the Filipinos that way, even as they are fighting in some cases in close proximity with black troops from the US, who of course hear this and know this. And they also, in fact, I think it was Daniel Immerwahr that mentioned this, they also refer to the Filipinos as gugus, which we think then is the origin of what comes to be gooks in the Vietnam War, right? So there's always an epithet for the enemy, right? And often in the modern age is kind of a racial epithet. But yeah,
But
anyway,
it's kind of a military parlance. Is that kind of the idea that it gets,
I mean, yes, because the Philippines are going to prove to be something of a crucible, for a lot of this stuff over the crime. I mean, we often look at World War I that way, and that's true, but we can find a lot of it already happening in the Philippines. So basically, what happens is the Filipinos take up arms against the US soldiers to try to assert their independence, but the US keeps doubling down. And by 1902, Aguinaldo's forces are so depleted. I mean, it's really a scorched earth thing. There's all kinds of devastating, tactics used, everything from, salting water wells to burning towns, burning fields, burning crops. Starvation will kill hundreds of thousands of Filipinos because the food supply is so disrupted, and this was part of the deliberate strategizing now of the US military to essentially starve out the enemy, and because they were frustrated, because the at first Aguinaldo tried to fight, kind of traditional fashion, but he was no match for the US. They didn't have the same kind of arms and, quality of weapons, and most of their leaders were guys in their 20s, and I think Aguinaldo himself was like 30 years old or something. I mean, he lives until 1964.
That's wild.
So, yeah, so he decided they couldn't fight that way, so they resort to guerrilla war, something that, the US should have known about, because that's what the US had done against Britain in the War for Independence. And in other words, these, as an upstart insurgent force, the Patriots in the War of Independence used guerrilla warfare tactics. But now it's the tables have turned, and it's the US is the imperial force. We're the redcoats, putting down a native uprising and using these same kinds of scorched earth strategies to do it. I found it interesting that one of the military commanders who set in to effectuate this is a guy by the name of Jacob Smith. And General Jacob Smith of the US Army. And the reason why I mention him is because Jacob Smith had been present with the US 7th Cavalry at what we now remember as the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1891, which was, of course, the firing on mostly unarmed civilian, that is, women, children, old, elderly people, Lakota, Sioux, tribal peoples in Dakota, that sort of officially marked the end of the Northern Plains Wars, but was really just was a massacre. Was they had their Hotchkiss cannons, the U.S. cavalry. They saw themselves as avenging Custer's loss, at the Little Bighorn, and so they basically just opened up fire with these modern grade howitzers and mowed people down. Well, Jake Smith was one of the commanders of that moment, and here he is now, a bit like a dozen years later, overseeing the rampage in the Philippines. He says, "I want no prisoners." I'm reading here from Dan Immerwahr's book, How to Hide an Empire. "I want no prisoners," Smith allegedly told his subordinate. "I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better you will please me." That from
Well,
Jake Smith.
no, and it's, I think it's important because you do see so many figures in that context of empire. You see so many figures like that who get moved from slaughter to slaughter, from massacre to massacre, from insurrection to insurrection, taking the lessons with them every time, right? That there's, you can find so many figures like that in the British Empire who, served in this particular war in East Africa, but then you also find them, fighting the Second Opium War And you find them, in India, and you find them, all over, and they just keep getting shipped around.
Like
I
Winston
mean,
Churchill, I think.
Winston Churchill is a good example as well. I mean, he seeks that out like a buzzard.
So what happens, here's what I want to say, is that I had always understood that the Philippine War was a dramatic scale of destruction, human loss. And the number that was usually floated was about 250,000 Filipinos. That is, in about a 3-year period, 250,000 Filipinos will die either as a result of direct military conflict or the associated breakdown of things like crop production and drinking water, clean drinking water. There was a massive spread of disease during this time, and there wasn't any medical remedy because the US wasn't going to, try to intervene that way. A real, I mean, if you're inclined to call something, I don't know, a Holocaust or maybe even something like a genocide, I mean, you're talking about a scale of destruction. But even that underestimates it, because what Daniel Immerwahr is saying in his book, How to Hide an Empire, which he published a few years ago here, which takes a much closer look at these little imperial small wars in these little corners of places, that the true number is undoubtedly closer to 700,000, because first of all, the time frame was truncated. The war didn't end. The war in the Philippines didn't end in 1902 with the surrender of Emiliano Aguinaldo, although that's what the president at that point, Teddy Roosevelt, proclaimed. Instead, it continued. And one of the areas it continued in the Philippines was the southern Philippine Islands, a place the U.S. Took to calling Moro Land. That is, the Moro people, Muslim Filipino peoples, who had a long tradition of independence. And even when the Spanish had claimed the Philippines as a colony, they never really governed directly or totally the Moros of the southern Philippines, living under their Islamic strictures and their own sort of political arrangements. This was a region that had long been involved with, sort of, maritime interests in the South China Sea. And, and it's here that the new insurrection is going to break out, because at first the United States seemed to think, oh, we should just leave well enough alone. They seem not to be a threat to our interests, with a larger population center up north in Manila, for example. And yet, imperialism is nothing if not sort of what carnivorous. And so ultimately, there will be a moment in which the US seeks to gain some sort of suzerainty or control over the Moro Islands and the Muslim peoples of the South Philippines. So what happens is that the war goes on, in other words, because they prove themselves to be more than capable and willing of defending their interests against the US. And as Daniel Immerwahr describes it, this is a conflict now. It's going to go on all the way till 1914, Josh, basically right up to the doorstep of World War I.
Which, I mean, that never penetrated any of my history
No,
classes. I mean,
and I
just,
never taught it that way. Believe it or not, I always sort of left off, with Aguinaldo's surrender. It officially makes it America's longest war, except for, the recent
Except for every war that's
record-setting war in Afghanistan, But that was always a thing, and growing up too, was the Vietnam was the longest war. So we got to put that on our checklist, right along with body counts or these sort of small wars that go long or something like that.
Well, no, I mean, this is the point that Lauren Benton makes, is that, the problem with those small wars is that she calls it serial violence. There's this kind of serial violence that just keeps up at sometimes lower levels, sometimes higher levels. And at times we start calling them wars, and then we stop calling them wars, but the violence continues at some lower level. And so, even that designation of wars is kind of,
Problematic.
kind of not particularly descriptive of the situation on the ground and the lives that are impacted by it.
And I'm thinking here in particular now of a photograph, and I would say a famous photograph, but thanks to the narcissism of power, you know, you see something and it makes such an impression on that you assume that everybody knows about it. But then you have to recall, you know, I don't know if I saw this more than just recently. I just think I've always known. You know what I mean? You have to, it gets you sort of asking, do I really know this? Or was this something successfully sort of kept off the, you know, off the radar of even what, as I, as someone teaching U.S. history, was knowing. But it gets, I guess what I want to say is it gets obscured, kind of the way you're talking about, you know, in Lauren's book, is that these things keep happening, but they somehow, in the narrative, you know, they get sublimated or something. And so the picture I'm thinking about is a picture that was taken in 1906 during this war in the Southern Philippines. It's a picture associated with what's called the Budajo Massacre, which was essentially an effort by the U.S. Battle regiments to dislodge Muslim fighters, Filipino fighters, from their defenses. This was essentially a volcanic shelf. In other words, you got to imagine a very austere kind of landscape here, you know, volcanic rock and steep grade. And these fighters had lodged themselves and by the defenses. And so the U.S. went all out with their artillery to dislodge them. But of course, in that sort of environment, you know, what I'm thinking here is of something like Gaza. In other words, if you have, you know, soldiers, fighters that are taking defense in and amongst civilian population areas, right? Which what this was, even though it strikes us as remote and austere, there were, you know, thousands and thousands of Filipinos who lived there who weren't, you know, active belligerents. They weren't fighters, but caught in the crossfire always. And it somehow, it just gets folded in. In other words, as long as you can keep the main, you know, focus on this idea that this is a military engagement, we're going after belligerents, and yes, they may be somehow, you know, hidden among civilian peoples, but you know, there's no helping it or something that, that yes, many civilians are going to die, that kind of thing. And so what this picture shows that I'm talking about, this photograph, and I'll put it in the episode notes ultimately, is soldiers standing, U.S. soldiers, standing over a trench filled with men's and women's corpses after what is called the Budajo Massacre of 1906. Mm-hmm. It's a posed picture. I mean, these guys are standing there knowing their picture is being taken. And while at their feet in this sort of trench is just a tangle of corpses, you know. Now, it's a photograph that reminded me of another photograph. So we double back once again to the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1891, is that at that point, the media had accompanied the 7th Cavalry, you know, into the Northern Plains, anticipating that there would be a fight. And the fight that came wasn't much of a fight because it was mostly impoverished Lakota migrants who were trying to make their way back in the midst of winter to the reservation lands the U.S. had created. And they were set upon by the 7th Cavalry, as they say, with their Hotchkiss cannons and their repeating rifles. And it was a bloodbath. But there's a famous picture in the aftermath of Wounded Knee that shows bodies in a trench, frozen because of the sub-zero temperatures. You know, you can imagine up in, you know, the northern plains in winter. The bodies are frozen into, you know, sort of statue-like, you know, agony almost, you know, in the death throes. And yet you have these U.S. troops that are sort of standing facing the cameras as if these were, you know, what, trophies of war or something. So, you know, within the span of a decade and a half, two different massacres, two different parts of the world, both of them, you know, in the agency of the U.S. military, both of them in the name of some grander, you know, principle. And it had me thinking, because this is where I'll finish it. Because, you know, when you're removed from this, I mean, we have current conflicts going on for sure that we get invested in following and you know, but when you're removed from something like the Philippine insurrection or you know what's called the Philippine insurrection or the Wounded Knee massacre or something, it's easier to see it in sort of academic terms. But just down the street here, as you know, Josh, from where I live in downtown San Jose, there's a park, St. James Park, that has a very prominent sort of memorial statue figure, and I had to look at it once because I could never quite tell who it was, so I ventured over and it's, oh, it's William McKinley. Now, again, William McKinley was president as much as anyone else, was the architect of American empire, right? In that formative period. I mean, it will be Teddy Roosevelt essentially, you know, who after McKinley is assassinated, you know, in 1902, after being elected, by the way, Immerwahr makes this point. McKinley runs against William Jennings Bryan in 1900. They had faced off 4 years earlier. It reminds me of Trump and Biden here because they ran against each other again in 1900. And by this point, a lot of the critique, the anti-imperialist critique, had come out about the war in the Philippines already by the time of that election. But far from hurting McKinley's election chances, re-election chances, he won by a larger margin. He extended his popular vote and his electoral vote in the election of 1900. So none of this hurt his political standing in the least. In fact, what the statue in St. James Park shows is not only a figure of McKinley, but on top of this pedestal that is decorated with all these sort of iconic objects. Okay. Now, I mean, on the one hand, here's what had happened. He had come to San Jose, apparently. To campaign, or excuse me, no, this was just after the election. Newly reelected, he had come to San Jose to do a little post-election campaigning and generate support, you know, for his policies and the war and whatnot, because there was a strong Republican. He was a Republican. There was a strong Republican contingent at the time in San Jose. All right, so 6 months after his, and he gave a speech in St. James Park that was attended by, you know, a couple thousand people. So 6 months later, he is assassinated, right, in New York State. And so the people of San Jose wanted to raise, I mean, this was a shock. They had just seen him. They wanted to raise this monument. And so they hire, you know, they put out bids, they hire a sculptor, et cetera, who designs this monument. And one of the things that makes it notable is that his words that he delivered that day in San Jose, 6 months prior to his death, are carved into the base of the statue. And one of the things that he said on that day, which you can read on the side of it, is, "Let us remember that our interest is in concord, not conflict." And so we have to think Victorian era use of the word concord means, of getting
Agreement.
along, right? Of getting along, harmony. In other words, let us remember that our interest is in concord, not conflict, and that our eminence rests in the victories of peace, not those of war. All right. So that's what's emblazoned on the side of the sign. Now, this is a guy who was saying this at the very moment that the Philippine insurrection was underway, right? It was before the Badajo massacre. That would happen 5 years later. But nevertheless, what was obviously going to be a very bloody conflict was already underway as McKinley, a guy who, by the way, was a veteran of the Civil War himself, no stranger to, you know, wartime destruction, nevertheless, chooses to, you know, enshrine this moment as a statement of Americans, what, peaceful intentions, I guess you would say. Now, okay. For lovers of irony, hang in there because I got an even bigger finish. If you go around to the back of the pedestal, as I say, there's all these other bronze figures that sort of populate the pedestal below McKinley himself. And on the back of the pedestal, there's an eagle with, and I looked up the report in the local newspaper right after the thing was unveiled, and there was a great description of it. There is an eagle, a bronze eagle with its wings outspread, right? Standing on a globe that is a model of the world. Okay, so that's the American eagle perched on the world, right? And here's what the reporter said. At the back of the steps, a globe representing the world is surrounded by an eagle with outspread wings. Beneath is the furled flag on one side, and on the other are the munitions of war, a sword, a cannon, and campaign hat. And again, that means a military hat. Two shields on each side bear the names of our new possessions, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the Philippines.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, there's that. That's the imperial logic, right? That there was at that point great powers, and the great powers took upon themselves the right to declare their ability and their desire to take lands. And that was understood to be legitimate. And then there was everybody else who, when resisting that kind of occupation, that kind of takeover, was labeled as savages, as barbarians. You know, in Kipling's White Man's Burden, right, he refers to the saboteurs of peace, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, saying that there would be war and the war would be savage, but peace would come out of it. That's part of the White Man's Burden. You have to fight these wars mm-hmm. to establish peace. So it's just such a common assumption that the kind of violence committed by, you know, McKinley's imperialism, the kind of violence committed in British imperialism, that all made sense as part of this global order that was being established, you know, right at that time, late 19th, early 20th century. And even as that imperial order falls apart post-World War II, the assumption still remains, as I've talked about, that that certain people have the right and certain people don't. Certain people are part of that civilized world and certain people aren't. You spoke about irony of McKinley, the imperialist, talking about the need for concord and peace. But Lauren Benton maybe pulls out an even more ironic example, which is a guy named Carl Schmitt, who was a member of the Nazi party in the 1940s, who wrote this piece. He's a jurist. He writes this piece on war, and he talks about the pacified order of Europe and the quarrelsome disorder of extra-European space. In Schmitt's view, according to Benton, the European legal order placed annihilating war outside its bounds in lawless extra-European spaces. Anti-imperial fighters were unmoored from the forces containing war in Europe. Once again, warfare beyond Europe made sense only as a deviation from practices in Europe. And then Benton adds, I think tongue firmly in cheek here, she says, the irony of Schmitt as an unapologetic servant of the Third Reich, relegating uncontrolled violence to spaces outside Europe, is difficult to miss. So it's one thing for McKinley, the imperialist, to be talking about it, but we literally have a member of the Third Reich, a member of the Nazi Party, critiquing this non-European world is a place of annihilating war, even as the Nazis and the Germans were annihilating entire populations or attempting to across Europe and the world. And
yeah,
that's that narcissism, right?
Yeah. And I think it would be a fun, we're going to have to meet at the tavern to have this debate. Ultimately is it really more ironic for the Nazi to be saying it, or are they birds of a feather? In other words, only if we would essentialize National Socialism as what? As an aberrant product of the liberal democracy, which I know you don't think it is. You know, it's just that we're conditioned to think for obvious reasons of the destructive, inherently destructive qualities of the National Socialist state. But I would argue, and that's why I brought up the wounded knee thing. I mean, because you had even some of the same people present at both. So this happened both in the domestic sphere of the United States and on the foreign front. And yeah, and you're right. I would say, whether you want to use Schmitt, the Nazi, or McKinley, the Republican, you know, and his statue, it'd be hard for me to think of a more sort of pronounced image of what we're calling the narcissism of power, because it pretends to be everything but what it is. You know, it deflects blame. It leaves damage and destruction in its wake.
Yeah.
And it sets up ultimately as a kind of what, in the case of the statue, in the leafy, you know, tranquil boundaries of an urban park, you know, as a place of meditation and of, you know, of solitude or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, the narcissism.
One of the things that actually got us thinking about a lot of this stuff, I mean, well, let's just say one of the things that got us to think in new ways about these things that we were already thinking about is you sent me probably a couple weeks ago now. And I never asked why you were reading this, but you found Toni Morrison's Nobel speech when she won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And it's this incredible speech, one of the most beautiful things I've read. And it's all about language and the danger of the both the beauty of language, but also the danger of language when misused. Where did you come across this, or why did you come across this?
Well, thanks. Thanks for the setup, because really, my wife Jenny had ordered the book,
okay,
as a gift for a friend whose birthday it was, and right. So I saw it sitting on her nightstand. I've read a little bit of Toni Morrison mm-hmm. over time, you know, but not ever really investing too much. And so, like you, I mean, you know, I just sat down and started reading the Nobel speech. And it was totally blown away and sent it to you. And
yeah,
I think it had the same effect on you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible speech. And it starts with this story of a woman lives on the outskirts of town. And Morrison describes her that, you know, in various versions of the story, she's this or that. But she chooses to see her as an old Black woman, the children of enslaved people, or the child of enslaved people. Who's seen in the town as a fount of wisdom and maybe even, you know, some kind of spiritual authority, the ability to kind of be a seer or something of that nature. She's blind and she's old. And in the story, these three young people, children in some version of the story, come to her. And in the telling of the story, they want to kind of test her. And so they ask her this question, since she's blind, she can't see what they have. And they say, we have a bird in our hand. Is it alive or dead? And that's where the story starts. And it's just this incredible reflection on, okay, so what does that mean? What's the point of that question? And because Morrison is a writer, she says, what this is really about is language. And the rest of the piece is this incredible story about language, in which there's a major turn at the end where the entire story changes. But I just want to read one particular passage, because it kind of speaks to language as a you know, as a tool of power, right? And the dangers of that. So this is what she writes. There is and will be rousing language to keep citizens armed and arming, slaughtered and slaughtering in the malls, courthouses, post offices, playgrounds, bedrooms, and boulevards, stirring memorializing language to mask the pity and waste of needless death. There will be more diplomatic language to countenance rape, torture, assassination. There is and will be more seductive mutant language designed to throttle women, to pack their throats like pate-producing geese with their own unsayable transgressive words. There will be more of the language of surveillance disguised as research, of politics and history calculated to render the suffering of millions mute, language glamorized to thrill the dissatisfied and bereft into assaulting their neighbors, arrogant pseudo-empirical language craft to lock creative people into cages of inferiority and hopelessness. And so the speech ends up being her rousing call to not let language devolve in this fashion, to use words as they're meant to be used, to use words not to serve power, but to push back against power. And I think as we kind of examine the discourse of violence in our world today, we need to be attuned to that misuse of language, be attuned to the way that it's serving, you know, some of the worst interest in our current globe, and to be careful and to be intentional about our language, because it does carry power, as mm-hmm. Toni Morrison says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oppressive language does more than represent violence, she says. It is violence.
Exactly, yeah. This has been episode 68. Thank you for listening. We will be back. I guess we used to be on weekly. Then we were bi-weekly, then we were monthly, and now we're whenever we feel like it. So stay tuned for whenever we feel like it again, and we will be talking to you hopefully in not too far into the future.
Nobody take care. Is
it's a sin when you play into ignorance. Another one closing your eyes again, so you don't have to see what's happening. Then now what's going on in these streets? You can't live by what you see on TV. Stuck in a cycle. so.